You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Welcome to Metalocker 72. Your eyes do not deceive you. That is not Amin El Hassan. That is the great Ray Ratto, San Francisco Examiner legend. And all of the things. We have Kate Fagan along with us as well. Amin will not be joining us today. He's doing other Amin-like things. And how are you, right?
I'm fine. I'm noticing Kate rocking the Serie A.
You know it. Some AC Milan here, Ray. Thank you for knowing your international clubs.
It's one of the few things I actually can master at this point in my life.
I can say nothing to this except that we have spoken soccer and I've been winging it. All I can say is, you know what's under my shirt, Ray? You want to know?
Do we?
The only thing I can tell you is I got a Powell's Books t-shirt on today.
Oh, there you go.
That is it. That's the, yeah, still one of the best independent bookstores in the country. We've got things to talk about today. We, before we go, our Metalocker 72 honorary captains, of course, Kate Fagan. Yeah, we got a long way to go. I was going to say we got what, another 30 years before we go. That was the year you were born, right? Not for you. 72. 72. We have, I'm going to start with Chicago White Sox, Carlton Fisk, 72. I will go with Ed Tootall Jones. I will also throw out as a significant 72, Bobby Orr, second Stanley Cup over the New York Rangers, 1972 Boston Bruins Stanley Cup champions. 72, not a good year for USA basketball. Obviously, the dreaded Olympics, 1972. And of course, it was the dawn of the most obnoxious champions in the history of obnoxious champions, the Miami undefeated Dolphins. Anybody else want to add to this, Ray, 72 for you?
Well, you took Tootall Jones, which I still maintain is the greatest single nickname in the history of sports, just because it told you everything you needed to know in two words. I also thought
Let's pause there for a second. Does that mean that he was really tall, but also not coordinated?
He was six foot nine. Ed Jones, defensive end, Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah. Okay. He was allegedly too tall for the position, but in fact, he was actually not too tall because he knew how to control 6 foot nine in a football world where everybody chop blocked all the time.
That's right. How tall was Ted Hendricks?
He was too tall to be believed. Mm-hmm. Hendricks, I believe, was 6'7".
6'7", yeah. Those are two huge dudes. I remember Tootall, obviously, as the Dallas Cowboys legend that he was, but also the strange day on Wide World of Sports where he ended up in a boxing ring. When he retired, he became a boxer.
Yeah, not his most inspired moment.
No, not at all. It did not go well. We are going to continue last week's conversation about rings culture. And Ray, I know you listened to the pod, so there's no huge intro in there. But I did want to jump into a place that we sort of tailed off at. And Kate, when we ended this, we were also talking about the changing nature of being a champion. One of the things that we were discussing on this was how when you think about championships historically, it had always been the ultimate team achievement. And now it feels like it's something that needs to go on the shelf. It's part of the brand. It's something that you have to have that actually really has nothing to do with team anymore. It's really sort of it's the individual accolade in a world of individual accolades.
As we were ending and thinking about that, the way I see the sports world right now and the way we talk about it, it doesn't seem like if you're visually thinking about, you know, an NBA trophy going in, you know, the trophy, what do we call those things?
Trophy case,
you don't even think of it as like, oh, that's going into, let's say, the Golden State Warriors trophy case. It mentally now, the trophy goes into a singular player's win column box. I don't even think of it anymore as like, oh, okay, well, you know, this is the new, well, it would never be the New York Knicks, but oh, this is the New York Knicks trophy. I always think of it now as going into the trophy case of an individual player. And that seems to be, occasionally we do dabble in the, is so-and-so a dynasty? Is that team, does that qualify as a dynasty? But really more than ever, we are talking about chalking up team awards to individual players' trophy cases.
And it's the CV.
Yeah, it's all part of their, you know, I'm trying to think of a fancier word than that. How do we say it?
Your portfolio?
Your resume.
Your resume, yes.
There you go. I'm trying to think
the
of that
body
French
of
word.
Work.
This hasn't been a good start for me. I can't think of a number of words, but that is, seems to be how we think of these things.
Yeah. Ray, when did you, like, we had, when Amin was talking about this last week, he sort of pinned it to the Charles Barkley, Karl Malone thing. But when we were talking about this earlier, I remember it was more of a sentimental thing. If you had played all these years and didn't have a championship, people weren't tearing you apart for it. They felt bad for you. Mm-hmm. It was like this, yeah, that you had actually gone, you know, if you were Ernie Banks, nobody was like, oh, yeah, Ernie Banks, loser, never won a championship.
No. Well, because I think back then, and Ernie Banks was the guy I thought of too, because he was the guy who, you know, indisputably great player, great shortstop, then a great first baseman. And his MO was, I love being at the ballpark. Let's play two. And so nobody could really get mad at him for that. And I don't know if, you know, if Amin's right or if it really started with the Buffalo Bills that went to four Super Bowls in a row and won none of them. But I think it sort of turned around that time. Because for a long time, the Bills got ripped for that, for not being good enough, for, you know, for Scott Norwood, for all of those things. And it only was like maybe two decades later when people suddenly realized, you know what they did was really hard to do, just getting there. And maybe we've been a little hard on them. But at the time, the Bills were getting hammered just year after year. And by the time they had gotten to their third, people were angry about them being there because they were sick and tired of, oh, they're just going to go there and they're going to get beat, which they did. And I also remember a year when there was a newspaper poll in Denver about the Broncos,
yeah,
where people said, would you rather they, you know, they won or not? And the poll came out, no, we'd rather they didn't win because all they're going to do is make us nervous and weird. You know, just they were angry at the fact that they couldn't win. And I think that was a moment as well where it's just, hey, you know, we don't want to know about the labor pains. Show us the baby. And the teams that couldn't show them the baby, you know, got castigated for it. And now it's to the point where, and Kate will know this wearing the shirt, is that in soccer, if you don't come away with at least one trophy, you've had a bad year, and the longer you go without winning at least one trophy, you know, the more they demand a new coach or a new owner or new players. It's give me something now and then give me something else in 15 minutes.
Yeah. Well, this is happening, though, in two different ways, though, right, Kate? I mean, on the one hand, what Ray's talking about is team. And I remember this as, you know, when we were kids as well. The Minnesota Vikings lost four Super Bowls. They didn't lose four in a row, but they lost four Super Bowls. The Denver Broncos lost four Super Bowls before they won two. And so it was the team. The Buffalo Bills had lost four. You know, and then it begins to translate to the player. One other thing, Ray, to remember about that period, too, is that we were also just in the midst of the worst Super Bowl era in history, where the game was over by the second quarter, where these were just bad Super Bowls. Now, the Bills played three Super Bowls and got smoked. And they played one close one. The first one was a close one. And then they just got demolished twice by Dallas. And then they got demolished by Washington. And so, but those years really did still criticize the team. The team took the weight. You know, did people walk out and look at Andre Reed's career and go, loser, and Thurman Thomas, loser, and Jim Kelly, loser? It then went from team and then really started to zero in on player. You now as player have underachieved. You are nothing.
But I remember Jim Kelly, you know, when the conversations were about, you know, is he a truly great quarterback?
Yeah.
That was the first weapon. And that's
and Elway.
Should have made clear is that that's when it started to go from
to the player
team failure to mm-hmm. player. Like Bruce Smith never got his due, and in considerable part because he was part of those Bills teams. It just, well, if you were any good, you know, you'd have a ring by now. You would have had a parade. You know, if you don't get a parade, then you're an incomplete player. And that's when I think that phenomenon sort of started.
It also seems like, you know, and Howard, we've talked on Meadowlarkers a lot about how teams used to reflect the identity of their city, or at least we told the story that they did. And in teams that we are naming now, it also felt like if they were struggled to win, couldn't win the big one, couldn't get over the top. I mean, you're living in Boston, so this was the history of Boston. It seemed like that team's inability to win was also reflective of something that had in the city, or something historically that had gone wrong, or something really deep in the
curse.
Like the yes, that's kind of what I'm getting to, is like with Buffalo, it seemed like at first it wasn't about the individual players and, oh, they must not have that special something, but it was like there's something in the energy of that franchise or that city that is almost mystically keeping it from getting over the top. And same with Boston for so many years. It was this really rich storytelling opportunity. But I'm curious how you think, how the way I think about Boston is like, it made it seem like there was this really mystical curse and that, but how did Boston overcome that mystical curse?
Yeah, and doesn't it go both ways, Kate? Because it's like, you know, to the end of our conversation last week. Yeah, all of us, aren't these narratives great? I mean, this is the funny thing about what we do for a living. We can just make shit up. Like we can just decide, yes, that's what we do. We lean into this, that we have decided that there is something in the DNA that is going to prevent you from winning. And I always tell people, in terms of the history of Boston, when the Red Sox lost in 46, they lost in 46. When they lost in 67, everybody was happy. Why were they happy? Because that team had been garbage for so long. And Tom Yawkey had talked about moving the Red Sox. Can you imagine the Boston Red Sox leaving Boston? That was the impossible dream season. Everybody was ecstatic. We're back. We're back on the map. This is the revival. The modern Boston Red Sox were born in 1967. 1975, when they lost, it was the greatest World Series of all time. In fact, I was at the Tucson Festival of Books a couple of weeks ago, and Pat Darcy, who gave up Carlton Fisk's home run in the epic Game 6, still, you know, during the panel said something along the lines of, the Red Sox still think they won that series 3-4. And so that really was the moment where we, as Bostonians, continued to fall in love. I mean, there was no, I mean, Yaz, you know, Carl Yastrzemski said it best. He says, hey, that was 1975. We had a young Jim Rice, a young Carlton Fisk, a young Fred Lynn. We just figured we'd be back next year. 86 changed everything. 86, suddenly it was the curse of the Bambino when the ball goes through Buckner's legs and all of a sudden, why can't this team win? It became a narrative that absolutely did not apply to the Boston Celtics and certainly didn't apply to the Patriots because they had never gotten there. It kind of applied to the Bruins, but people used to laugh at the Bruins. It wasn't like the Bruins always lost in heartbreak. They just lost to Montreal, which was the equivalent of like losing to Duke every year. And so it was like it became its own narrative. And then it became something to hold on to, the same way the Cubs held on to it with the Billy Goat curse, the curse of the Billy Goat Tavern and the rest of it. And in the Cubs case, you looked at it and you were like, well, wait a minute. No, this is just an excuse for you guys having tons of money and not knowing how to spend it. You're completely incompetent. And then it works on the flip side, which is what we also ended up with last year. Then all of a sudden, the Patriots win a Super Bowl. They've got no business winning. And then the Red Sox win a World Series. They had no business winning. And then the Celtics suddenly make a trade and total inside deal between Danny Ainge and Kevin McHale to suddenly have Kevin Garnett end up in Boston. And then they win a championship. And then the Bruins, after blowing a 3-0 lead to the Flyers, the next year they win a championship. And so now we're the city of champions. And now suddenly Boston has the special sauce that makes them unbeatable in finals, right? I mean, the Bruins and the Celtics have lost in finals. The Red Sox haven't lost a World Series in 20 years. And so, I mean, the last time the Red Sox lost a World Series was 1986. And so suddenly the narrative has totally shifted that now this is the tough city that when they get to a championship round, they don't know how to lose. It's amazing how that can all happen in the same damn place.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead, Kate.
No, right, please. I'll jump in after.
Nope. It's a lot of what's happened in the Bay Area since 2010. The Giants were the hopeless team that could never see a World Series, let alone win one.
And then they became championship blood.
Yeah, and then they won 3 in 5 years, all with teams that probably weren't as good as the teams they were playing. The Warriors, who had been just bereft for 40 years, suddenly win, you know, 3 in a row, get to 5 finals in a row, and then win one last year they had no business winning. The 49ers got to a Super Bowl and 2 conference finals in the last 4 years. But nobody remembers that they haven't won a Super Bowl in 28 years. It's that, hey, we're a factor again. It's the art of illusion where you convince yourself of things that either are or aren't and decide that it's a part of what you did just by living there. And I think that sort of transfers into, you know, why you get angry at players when they don't win a championship. It's just, how did you let me down? I thought you were winning. Now you suck. And it's a hilarious part of sports to the point where now it's used as a weapon by players against other players. Like Klay Thompson, you know, holding up 4 fingers to Dylan Brooks. Say, hey, I got 4 rings, you got none. You know, so now it's not only part of fan culture, it's a part of player culture.
Yeah.
Can you imagine somebody looking at Dr. J and, you know, like, and looking at, you know, you don't have any rings, Julius, right? Before 1983. I don't think that would have gone over too big.
Yeah.
No.
One of the things we kind of touched on in last week's episode that I am perpetually fascinated by is just the concept of luck. Because in the outside world away from sports, if you suggest that everything you have in your life is purely through your own character, willpower, effort, it is mostly deemed as narcissism. You have to allow for the, you know, whatever it is, like the luck, the opportunities, the fates that have come into your life at one point or another. But within the sports world, as we talked about, the second you win a title, maybe in that game, you realize the lucky bounces you've gotten, the lucky breaks you've gotten. But the second that title is yours, it almost solidifies into an ownership that you have something special inside you that allowed you to become a champion. And so the idea of luck and the way athletes treat luck is really interesting to me. It's so interesting that in the week between these two episodes, I went back and read one of my favorite articles of all time, which was written by Ramona Shelburne in 2016 about Kobe Bryant. And this is what, if you just give me a second here, there's this one part that's kind of always stuck with me. And so this is Ramona here. Growing up, Kobe followed his father, Joe Jellybean Bryant, everywhere. He'd sleep with his basketball clothes on, so Joe couldn't say no when he'd asked to go to practice with him. But as Kobe grew older and learned of the disappointments of his father's NBA career, it was harder to relate. Joe was a 6'9" forward with the skill set of a guard that would be in vogue in today's NBA, but in the Eastern Conference of the late 1970s, he was miscast as a defensive specialist. According to Joe, his whole career would have been different if he'd been in a different system and been able to play on the perimeter like Magic Johnson. This is Kobe's quote. When I hear those things, I don't really understand them. Why should the whims of fate, which system he played in, determine the success of a man's career? How could his father accept that? There is always a way to bend things to the way you want them. And this always stuck with me because what Kobe seems to be saying is that in every iteration of Kobe's life across time, right? Like if at any time we play out the scenario of Kobe Bryant's career, he ends up with numerous NBA championships. He has to believe that fully. There is no world in which Kobe Bryant is drafted like 13th by the Milwaukee Bucks and they're terrible and he gets stuck under a bad coach and then he tears his ACL and he can't come back and he has bad teammates around them. And there is no, in Kobe Bryant's mind, there's no version of a career where he wins no NBA championships. And I understand to some degree why athletes need to believe this, because you can't step onto the court or field and think, I have no control over what happens here. But athletes tend to take it to an extreme where I am in full control of my destiny, except for this one area, which Howard and Ray, I'm sure you'll get, superstition. There is the gray area of superstition in sports, especially in baseball, but they wouldn't really call it luck, right? It was like, it's this element of fate that you supposedly have convinced yourself you have some measure of control over. So to me, that's like the one area where athletes are allowed to acknowledge that luck exists, but they can't call it luck. They have to call it superstition so that they can execute on it. And I find just the whole area of luck and superstition and how athletes address it really fascinating.
Yeah, well, and it is interesting because what you end up with is everybody wants to be the hero of their origin story, right? They want to be the hero of their narrative. They can't see it any other way. And because of that, they also talk themselves into the belief that I am in complete control of everything. And if you're Kobe Bryant, he made sure he wasn't playing for the Charlotte Hornets, right? I mean, because that was also, you know, part of his destiny. He made sure that wasn't part of his destiny. I think the other thing when you're a basketball player, and we've talked about this before, but when you're a basketball player, basketball lends itself to that way of thinking because it is a best player win sport. Basketball players win because they have so much control over the two ways of the court. If you're that good, you win. And generally speaking, in the history of the NBA, I don't think the only guy I can think of who can honestly make the argument, I'm the best player in the game today and didn't win a championship, was Elgin Baylor. I never thought Patrick Ewing was the best player in the NBA. I never thought Charles Barkley was the best player in the NBA. I never thought Karl Malone was the best player. Usually, if you're top of the top of the top, you find your way to a championship, at least. And even in Ewing's and Karl Malone's case, in basketball, all of the greatest players play for a title. Who is the greatest player in NBA history who never even got to the finals? I mean, you do have that much influence over the outcome of the sport.
No yeah. question. I mean, and Baylor is, that's a great example because I don't know how without watching him play or seeing actual useful clips of him playing that you get a sense of what an extraordinary jumper and shooter and all the skills that would make him a phenomenal player now, he displayed on a nightly basis, 3,000 miles away from the places where people cared most about basketball. And that he sort of gave up Well, he didn't give up his career. He had a career where he got there so many times and had it snatched away from him because Bill Russell, if you want to talk about guys who had an indomitable will, just said, well, no, you guys don't get to win this one either. You know, yeah. Keep
hey,
coming.
Can I stop
you're
you
always
right there?
Welcome in our building, but we're going yeah. to make you cry in the end.
Yeah. Can I stop you right there? Because even someone like Baylor, you know, and I never got to see Baylor play. I was 3 years old when he retired, nine games into the 72 season, when they actually won it, and he retired.
Yeah, he was bitter about the fact that you didn't pay enough attention to him.
I bet. And he took that to his grave.
Starting is everything when it comes to fitness. Peloton helps you start no matter what level you're at. Wherever you're starting, there's thousands of classes to get you moving. Whether that's beginners or advanced rides, feel-good live DJ rides, or artist-themed rides, they've got something for you. Peloton bike instructors keep you motivated from day one. They'll show you the basics, help take the guesswork out of your workout, and encourage you to build from there. And now with Peloton Entertainment, you can keep moving and watch your favorite TV shows and live sports as you ride. Perfect for those days when you don't want to miss a thing. And if you don't have a bike, take a dance class, take a core class, take Pilates, take a stretching class, start a program with Andy, do a core program with Emma. You can do it all at Peloton. You can get a Peloton row, and you're not even going to get wet because it's inside your own house without water. How'd they do it? I don't know. Wherever you're starting, get moving with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike rentals. Terms apply.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
The bend to the will thing, to the Joe Bryant piece, right? Back then, the style of the NBA, the style of basketball, was always it was a big man's game. Could you make some sort of cosmic argument that if you had put Elgin Baylor in Michael Jordan's area, you know, in his era, that suddenly he wins because now we're accepting in the Julius Erving area where we're accepting now that that Elgin Baylor gets to dominate everything, even though he's not a center? Maybe, except for one little piece. Elgin Baylor was still averaging 38 a game. Back then, with no 3 points. So it's not like, what more could he have done? The bottom line is, he played a better team. Shit didn't go right when he needed to. There was, you know, whether it's the Frank Selvey shot or the Don Nelson shot or whatever other cosmic stuff happened, that is something you can't always bend to your will. And I think it's also something it's also part of the Kobe mythology as well. So it's become, it's to the point you were making last week, Kate, that once, remember how you put it, that once you win, you become dipped in gold. And now you can dip yourself in that gold because you constantly reinforce that narrative. And we all know, you know, there were numerous instances where Kobe Bryant's career could have gone in many different directions. Kobe Bryant also, right, when he did win championships, was playing on the best team in the league.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's like, let's also remember that Laker team was super stacked.
Yep.
It's not as though he was taking the 82 Denver Nuggets and willed them to a championship.
And that's
the narrative, you know, that's what,
yeah,
when you win, you get to create this.
And that's what I find fascinating is we obviously can't prove a counterfactual. Like, there is no version of Kobe Bryant's career where he doesn't win NBA titles. And
he's
so
a
then
multiverse.
Yeah, in the multiverse, And he's not allowing for the fact that in the multiverse, enough things could go wrong for him that he wouldn't. He's saying, like you just alluded to, I think you actually said about Bill Russell, like the indomitable spirit, which this is maybe blasphemy. And it's, you know, I'm of a different era than watching Bill Russell. But is it possible that maybe Bill Russell's just a guy who they won one title and all of a sudden you start to think, all right, maybe I got the special something, which leads you to have more confidence. Then you surround yourself and you're in a world where, and here my knowledge is coming from Adam McKay's, you know, Showtime show about the Lakers and those original battles with Red Auerbach. Mm-hmm. Winning Time, sorry. With Winning Time, and they're alluding to the mystique. Is it possible that Bill Russell's just a guy who was really good at basketball and who won one and then got some momentum, and not that he has a spirit that's greater than other players?
Yes, but it's the same point. It's the Kobe point, right? Hang on one quick. Yeah. It's the Kobe point, right? Once you win, you get to rewrite it any way you like. And, you know, the fact that they won 8 straight titles, the fact that, I mean, it becomes the mythology. You win 8 straight titles. You win 11 out of 13. You go undefeated in your entire life in elimination, winner take all games, right? I mean, so this thing is starting to build. You're creating this, even though the ball could have bounced any way that it bounced when it bounced, right? I mean, there's a lot of different things that winning is hard, but here's the other piece of it, right? That is always the difference maker. And Ray jump in on this. And this is, at the end of the day, we take this element of thing that we can't understand, and we have to assign meaning to it. This is proof. And the other piece of this is proof of my will over yours, because that's when we start getting into the mental toughness and the greatness code and the clutch gene and all the other bullshit that we talk about. But then the other piece of this, for anyone who's ever competed, anyone who's ever been in any sort of competitive situation, any sort of alpha, boardroom, whatever you want to call it, there are people who intimidate you. And in sports, it is that place where you see people blink. Shots go in where they're not supposed to go in, or I play better when this happens, or there is something about watching this live drama where it is you versus me, and I do think you're afraid of me, and I think I'm tougher than you, and maybe you'd beat that guy's ass, but you're not going to play as hard against me because there's a piece of me that intimidates you, you know? And Russell, I mean, the famous one, of course, is Russell and Wilt in 69, where supposedly, you know, Russell is yelling at Wilt on the bench, get out here and play, you know? And it's like, why didn't Wilt Chamberlain, the greatest offensive player in the history of the sport, why didn't he beat Russ? All of it? It all goes into the same thing that we can't quantify, but we can look at the scoreboard.
Yeah, and beyond that, I mean, Russell was that intimidating guy. He made other players believe eventually, I always win because I've always won. Because don't forget, before he got to the Celtics, he led an otherwise unassuming University of San Francisco team to 2 national championships.
That's right.
He was the reason. So, you know, even though he had to reprove that with the Celtics, you know, after they lost that one championship to the Hawks, and then they started on their run, you could look at the Celtics and say, this is the guy who's changed his position, because now you have to be an athletic big who blocks shots and gets rebounds and starts the fast break and does all the things that none of the other centers can do. And then you put him up against the most dominant player maybe in any sport ever, in Wilt Chamberlain, and he wins every year because he either has the better team or he performs the greater deeds when it matters. And sure, some of that is luck. If Chamberlain had been drafted, you know, by St. Louis and had to stay in that town, you know, maybe we're not talking about this the same way, but after a while, it gets its own legs.
Or if Russell stays in St. Louis and doesn't get traded to the Celtics.
Well, exactly. I mean, just it's because, I mean, ultimately, you know, the Hawks were worried that, well, you know, I don't know that a great black player will go over in our still profoundly racist town. And so they were happy to move him on. And as a result, they haven't won a championship since 1957. Maybe in part because of that one decision.
58,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Let's switch gears.
I knew you'd correct me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Well, and here's the other thing, right?
I might add.
Ray, you know what I love about that, though? Is that even that one, where the Hawks beat the Celtics in six games, Russell had the twisted ankle. He had the sprained ankle. So even that, I would have won 12 in a row, or I would have won as many, you know. It was like, there was a reason why my greatness code didn't click in, you know, in 1958, because if I got hurt and they won, I was playing, I was impaired. But let's switch gears for a second and go to the flip side to all of what we're talking about. And that is Damian Lillard and his point. What does all of this mean to the player today? So we've taken this from the Buffalo Bills and from Karl Malone, and we've taken it from the Minnesota Vikings and the Broncos and Charles Barkley and all of it. And now we apply it to today's player. And today's player, we all know, doesn't even necessarily feel, except for Dame, he's one of the few players who does make the relationship between player and team. This team drafted me. I feel loyal to this organization and this city. This city is an extension of my personality, and I'm going to win or lose with it for now. But if you're a player, the pressure of our conversations and the conversation creates culture. Can you beat that culture? Can you overcome this idea that rings culture is here to stay? If you do not win, you have to go to a place where you can win. If you're Dame Lillard, no matter how many different great, humanistic, individually smart points you make, as soon as we hang up the phone, everyone's like, yeah, but he ain't winning. And so how do you overcome, or can you, Ray, can you overcome what this culture is? Or do you have to go, yeah, I got to call my agent. I'm in my 13th year. It's not going to happen in Portland. And this culture is going to beat me into the ground if I don't go to some place where I'm playing in June.
Well, the easy answer is no, because the culture isn't going to change, because the culture has always been that to one extent or another. It's only exacerbated now, and especially in the NBA, because in the NBA, players can force trades to better situations. That doesn't happen in football. It almost never happens in baseball. It surely doesn't happen in hockey. It happens some in soccer because there are teams that can pay for great players, but, you know, other teams can't. But in Lillard's case, I think he is stubborn enough and principled enough to say, I'm not going to let you define me. I call it a peculiar.
And history will absolve me on this.
Hmm?
And history is going to absolve me. I'm going to make this call and I'll be all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think, and this is an incompletely formed thought, but I've always thought part of that was because he's always spent his career having to prove people that they're wrong about him. And I think this is basically the latest phase of that, where he could easily force a trade. He could easily just say, you know, get me to Golden State. You know, I can be the bridge between Curry and whatever happens next. But I think in his mind, that's an acceptance of a different defeat, where he says, it's almost like I'm gaming the system and shortchanging my own abilities by saying, I've been a victim of circumstance in Portland. And I don't think he goes there mentally.
But wasn't that Amin's point last week, where Amin was like, well, yes, you also have the right and the responsibility to say, hey, Portland, as an organization, you're not holding up your end. And I think that's a different conversation. But part of this conversation, part of this culture, is also, hey, we're going to hold the organization accountable too. That's the reason why I'm leaving. I'm not clout chasing. You're not holding up your end. Okay, go ahead.
I think I said this last week too, when it comes to, you know, I think Dame right now is sort of our avatar for this conversation, but I think this is actually applies to even non-athletes in this culture. He's defining what greatness is to him. What a great career.
Or actually success.
Yeah. He's defining what success looks like to him. And some people seem angry because there are more variables than just winning an NBA championship. He has plugged in other variables to his equation. It's, if you listen to him, it sounds like quality of life, quality of relationships, all of those things are in his equation for what success looks like. And because he has a different equation than what we would expect from what we deem a sort of narcissistic, and I'm not necessarily using that as a negative if you're an athlete, you know, it's like ego-driven, chasing in this rings culture, he's defined it differently. And I think that like all of us on every different level are doing some version of that. And we've talked about this previously on Meadowlarkers. Like I use this example of like, if you opened a bakery in your hometown and everyone's like, well, when are you expanding next? And maybe your ambition is to just make great cupcakes and cookies and baked goods for that one town. You're not trying to scale to globalization. It reminds me a lot of this question. There's this very funny Onion article. It's like unambitious loser with happy, fulfilling life still lives in hometown. And the whole article are people who moved away, coming back, being like, this guy, he works 6 hours a day. He says he's happy. He has fulfilling relationships, but he doesn't have some huge career pursuit. We don't get it. We're miserable living in the city.
And we don't respect that.
Yes. And but it's weird because the whole article is talking about like it very much applies to Dame. He's saying, I am living a happy, fulfilled life where I'm striving within the parameters of the life I've created to be the best I can be. Because I am unwilling to change those parameters based on what the culture is saying will define me, you have deemed me essentially the unambitious loser with happy, fulfilling life still lives in his hometown. And so it's a juxtaposition for Dame, I think, of if he does win that title, is it worth it long term to have sacrificed everything that he has to live with on the day to day because maybe he'll get name checked every once in a while on First Take 3 in 2055? You know, that's an equation that I can't, that doesn't quite
well,
add
and
up.
It really is something interesting about it too, because I was thinking about this during the World Series last year. It was a little bit different, obviously, because it's a career goal, but the, you know, Ray, you can relate to this, the Dusty Baker story, you know, and for me, that was one of the most excruciating postseasons to watch. And I will admit this, even as a journalist, because I don't usually feel this for a lot of people. I like Dusty Baker as a human being. And it was, you know, it was really, I was actually hoping he would win, not because it matters if he wins or if he doesn't win. His life is going to be the same. He is great. He's a Hall of Fame manager regardless. But what I was concerned about in watching the World Series last year was the place with Dame where you run that risk of falling into, which is now you become the trivia question. Greatest X not to win. Greatest this not to win. And guys are very much aware of that. They don't want to be that. If Houston doesn't win that World Series, Dusty Baker is the only manager in Major League history with 2,000 career wins and not and no World Series title. He's the only manager in Major League Baseball history who has been to at least three World Series and not won the World Series. He's all of those things, right? They all win. And then suddenly, and because this culture has that mean-spirited hook to it, clearly the explanation isn't the weird ass, you know, fates that got in the way. It's you. You're the reason why you don't win. And that's the other piece of it, why I think a lot of people feel the need to win a championship just to get away from that question. It's not even necessarily the joy of wouldn't it be great to win the last game of the season. It's I can't have people talking about me like this, which is a very different motivator.
Well, and just him taking the Houston job, you know, I can't imagine why he would have taken it other than to get one last crack at winning the last game, because there was nothing about that organization that frankly.
We got into an argument about that, Ray. I called Dusty and I was in his office and I said to him, when I finally saw him, I was in his office. I said, why are you here? Why did you do this? I said, why did you sat up there in that press conference and you took all the bullets for some shit that had nothing to do with you. You are putting your good name on this organization. And they don't deserve you. And his response was twofold. One, I want to work. He wanted to still be in the game to the point of, I want to do this. Like the Ernie Banks thing, I like coming to the ballpark. Dusty Baker's a baseball man. And nothing else has really fulfilled or replaced that. He don't like being in the broadcast booth. He doesn't like being in the studio. He's a baseball man. He's like, I want to work. But the other thing he said was the point you just made. He's the gunslinger going into town for one last score. I want this and I don't have it. I've won the World Series as a player. I got to have this and I'm going to give it one more chance to get it.
And I also think that, you know, players and managers and people on the field create their own narratives too in their own heads.
They do.
And I think he viewed the Houston job as not only one where success could be had, but that he'd be saving the bacon of a bunch of very unworthy white guys who had turned it into a cesspool. He said, I'm going to save your reputations, even though you don't deserve it. And I think that might have been part of sort of the subliminal motivation as well, is that nobody's going to take this away from me because I ran the table narrative-wise. Yeah. I basically saved the franchise that had been condemned as the most corrupt in sports, which is also not true, but it's part of that narrative. That he won a World Series that was bigger than life. And I think that's why he took the job to begin with. And when he got paid off, I was like you, because, you know, I don't know him as well as you do, but I know him pretty well. I mean, I was thrilled for him. I could not have been less interested in how Jose Altuve celebrated, or, you know, or Mickey or Michael Brantley or any of them, or Alex Bregman. Those didn't matter to me. Dusty Baker had put in 50 plus years of this, and he finally hit the royal flush.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's going to be the thing on his Hall of Fame plaque that isn't written.
And that's compelling.
But it's there.
Yeah, and that is compelling. I mean, you look at, I think one of the things that's been really interesting about where we are in this sort of stage that we're in, both in our lives, of course, having covered this and been in this game for as long as we've done it, but also just sort of where we are culturally, is there is something to be said for a life's work. And, you know, when you talk to Doug Collins, to this day, Doug Collins is still heartbroken about the 72 Olympics. It's his life, his whole life, that moment he's never gotten over. And I find it compelling, and I don't really believe in any direction where, okay, you are deserved this. But I do love the quest. I do love the idea of the quest. I don't, you know, I don't look at the idea of, okay, he must win to be complete. But I do love the idea that I'm chasing this thing. I just watched a fantastic movie a few weeks ago over at Film Forum in New York, Turn Every Page, the Robert Caro, Robert Gottlieb movie. And here's Robert Caro, who has been writing a Lyndon Johnson opus for my entire life. For 54 years, he's been working on this subject. And I just found it so admirable in a lot of ways to think about this in terms of a life's work.
When you were, Howard, when you were talking about Dusty Baker and him conveying the, I gotta have this, that as a World Series, as a manager, was something not only that he was missing and that people, the culture was telling him was missing, but that internally he wanted it, that I gotta have this mentality. I don't think that that is true of all athletes.
No, and it is not. Coaches. And Kate, let's also be clear about speaking. Let's not speak in pronouns here. When Dusty was saying, I got to have this. Do you know what this was? This was the World Series as the key to unlock a door that's really important to him. No manager that has ever been inducted into the Hall of Fame didn't win a World Series. He is like, I got to have this. In other words, I need this in order to go there. And there is Cooperstown.
Yes. Okay. So maybe it was twofold, right? He sees what it does externally.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's also internal. There's some merging.
And it's also missing. It's also the fact that I've won the manager of the year three times and I've done all these things, but I don't have this. And everyone's going to, you know, remind me, or I'm going to remind myself that I just didn't get this one piece.
Yes. And what I think is always interesting to convey about this is I think people look at sports from the outside and they think, well, everyone feels that. I got to have a title. Not all athletes feel that way. And a lot of athletes probably were never the people who were like, I got to have that title, but they ended up in the right place at the right time and they got a title. And there's just as many athletes who were like, I got to have a title, and they never ended up with a title. I guess this leads me back to my intrinsic belief, which is that, do I think there are outliers where they truly might be dipped in some sort of gold or have some sort of ability to bend fate to their will? Okay, I'm allowing that could be true, but the vast majority of athletes sort of ended up in certain circumstances and have rewritten their stories to mean something that they didn't always mean.
Well, and here's the other piece of this, you know, and Ray, jump in after this. Dusty's narrative has shifted, because after he wins, I'm on the phone with him a couple of weeks later, and he's upset that people are talking about him in these terms. He's like, I didn't need this. I was already complete. Wait a goddamn minute.
Wait a second.
No, you weren't. No, you weren't. You have wanted this piece for a really long time. He's like, I don't. And what it was the pride speaking. It was, yeah. I don't need anybody's pity. I don't need, you know, don't tell me I wasn't, you know, I look at all the things I've done in this game. So suddenly he's in the dipped in gold thing. Now it's the whole, two championships is better than one. Now he's suddenly, let's go with another one. And the whole thing is shifted. And I think part of the reason it shifted was because he didn't like that win it for Dusty stuff. It offended him as a competitor. It was like, I don't need your pity. Yeah. I don't need your, you know, I don't need, you know, your sympathy.
I'm not the bench warmer going in at the end of the game, hoping they get a basket. Stop it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But no gift baskets here.
Yeah. But the side piece in all of this that I think secretly pleases Dusty as much as anything is that he's also sort of midwifed this resurgence in the old manager.
Like, also true.
Coachy got a new job in Texas, in part because the Rangers saw, you know what? Look what he did in Houston. You know, Buck Showalter's back in the game. You know, Terry Francona's been in Cleveland forever. It's all of a sudden all these 37-year-old managers who flame out in a year and a half because they don't know that being a manager means being a people manager and that you can only learn it by doing it.
And all these 28-year-old Ivy League GMs are realizing, I can't teach that.
Yeah.
I actually need these guys now.
Well, and actually that the owners of the franchises that employ all the 28-year-old general managers going, well, he did that. Why do I have to buy beer for my manager? Why can't I get a guy who can buy beer for me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what he's going to take with him as his own narrative, which is, I not only proved that I was worth it, I proved that guys of my generation who did this year in and year out, you know, are
the experience matters. And especially, Ray, as you know, in that sport where the culture war taking place in baseball is, your experience doesn't matter. And what you know about the game doesn't matter. And the beating heart of the game doesn't matter. And everything that you've brought to the table all these years, we don't need that anymore. And he's provided a corrective to that.
Yeah. And let me bring that back to Damian Lillard, because all those 28-year-old general managers who believe that everything of value must be counted, Damian Lillard is the complete opposite of that dynamic, which is, okay, my ring count is zero and my parade count is zero, but I have found something that I value more. I can force a trade anytime I want, and I know that. And I can put myself in a different situation that enhances my chances of winning. And I know that. But I choose not to, because I don't need to count my accomplishments and I don't need to count my career. My career exists as a broader thing than just math. And I think one of the things that has come with, you know, the ring culture is that rings are easy to count because they come in increments of one. You know, if you have four rings, like Klay Thompson keeps telling Dylan Brooks, that doesn't make you four times as good a player.
No, but it as Michael Jordan used to say to everybody else, well, six is more than five and six is more than one. And, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I always thought it was hilarious when Bill Russell would come to, you know, a Hall of Fame ceremony. And the one time he was on the stage with all the other big guys and he never said anything about the number of rings he won. But he looked at them all with that little impish smile and you said, I could have kicked all your asses. And unspoken in that is, because I've got a bigger trophy case than you. My me room is bigger than all of yours put together. And he didn't have to say it, but it just existed as an ethereal thing. And I think in some ways, maybe that's where Dame Lillard is.
Yeah. I also think, too, that there is it is also an extension of empire. You know, we talk about where we are in this culture. And one of the things I love about our program here is that we do talk about this in so many different ways. And one of the things that we've seen in this culture so often is the separation or the destruction of the public versus the private, the whole versus the individual. And the conversation over championships has been completely co-opted. It is now an individual thing. And it used to be the ultimate team accomplishment. And I think that when you're watching and you're digesting how we talk about championships, it runs completely counter to everything that we are supposed to be taught about championships. And that's why, to me, the rings culture rings so hollow, no pun intended. That's why, to me, it feels so fake. Because what we're really talking about is whether you, as individual, have the measurables for us to talk about you as an individual, which really has absolutely nothing to do with winning in a team sport. On that, let's go. Does anybody speak now or forever hold your peace for the next 7 days, have any final thoughts? Ray Ratto, thanks for joining us on your maiden voyage on the Metal Lockers, by the way.
This was phenomenal fun. Let's do it in a half an hour. No, I think it's also all of this dovetails into one other phenomenon that is, and I don't want to put it in such a facile way, but it's the fantasy sports world. Nobody ever drafts a team. They draft individuals. So their entire frame of reference is individuals.
And those individuals on your fantasy team don't have to interact with each other.
Exactly. It's a sterile world that's easy to quantify. When in fact, sports is an incredibly complicated world that can only be qualified. It can't be quantified. You can stack up numbers all you want. And thank God for Baseball Reference for being able to do that for us. But as a working entity, even individual sports, you know, it's the interplay of you and not only other people, but the interplay between you and the self you believe you are. I mean, and all those things are incredibly complicated and hard to encapsulate. So most people don't want to bother to encapsulate them anymore because there are too many things you can't answer in the end. It's easier to go, well, he won a ring. That means he is X because the formula is 1 = X.
That's right. And he didn't win a ring, which means he or they are not.
Yeah. Final thought. 0 = Y.
Yes. Final thought, Kate Fagan.
I'm good. In fact, I won't offer a final thought because my disk space is full on my recorder, so it wouldn't even come through on this show if I said it.
It will not measure. In that case, for Kate Fagan, Ray Ratto, and the in absentia Amin El Hassan, I'm Howard Bryant. We will see you next week on Metal Lockers 73. And for all the New Yorkers out there, I will just say 73, last championship of the New York Knicks, and rest in peace, Willis Reed.
Hear, hear.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yeah! The Vandercoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.